We are now audio recording to the cloud. So welcome all to the March 31st Q&A. Just a reminder that anybody who's not a member, if you want to join, recommend you do it today. You'll get a second year for free. So you can go to our website to do that, and you can pay with either a PayPal account or any major credit card. And we got a pretty full deck tonight, so I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through the deck for tonight. So, Alan, it's all yours. And you'll have to unmute yourself.
There we go. I always forget where the control is once I share the screen.
Yeah.
However, okay, so as Chris said, we have a number of different topics tonight, and today is March 31st, so everybody's well aware that it's World Backup Day, because everybody's taken the pledge, right? The pledge is the text in yellow there. So today is a good day, every day is a good day, to make a full system backup and protect ourselves from all evils. Okay, in the newsletter and last week, I talked about the board of directors looking for suggestions for meeting topics, and especially looking for speakers for the club. And we're interested in either monthly meetings or regular meetings, members' favorites, which we run from time to time. And in September, if you check the newsletter, we have a competition. There's a 2 terabyte portable hard drive going spare for the best presentation by a non-board member, I might add. And also for things like tonight, question and answer sessions. And we're always looking for topics, and we're always looking for questions and answers and things that people want to share. I must say I've been underwhelmed by the response so far, so I hope people are listening tonight. One of the ideas that was touted was the history of USB connections, the various plugs and ports and powered hubs and all those kind of good things. So if anybody knows all about the above or wants to research it and enlighten your colleagues, please let us know, and we'll be pleased to slot you in somewhere. And another suggestion that came in, I guess I'll let Chris talk about. Except he's muting himself now too.
Yes, I did. Unless Linda wanted to talk about it, it was actually her idea. Linda, did you want to chime in?
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. So Linda noted that, you know, a lot of people put up information either in Q&A or in the member forum, or just while you're browsing the web, you come across interesting things. And she had the idea that it might be kind of neat if there was an ongoing article that gets posted into the newsletter, really brief. So just a one-liner with a link to a website or something like that on things like emerging technologies or fun sites that you go to, or a particularly interesting website that had some information that you thought other people should know about, just putting basically a title to it or one sentence and then a URL. And, you know, some months there might be 2 or 3, some months there might be 6, some months there might be none. So if anybody's interested in picking up the task on this, let us know. And we'll be happy to work with you to get it. And this is just a sample that I threw together of the way that I thought might make sense. So just, very, very brief and just a couple of interesting articles. So as I say, if anybody's interested, I'll let us know, and we'll be happy to get you set up with the newsletter editor.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So a follow-up to last week, I was saying I had this problem with trying to run Audacity in Windows, and it was giving me this Windows system error, too many posts to a semaphore or some such. And I checked today, and there's still nothing on Feedback Hub, which I kind of expected. A few days ago, I was thinking I should also post a bug report to Audacity itself, So one of the things they wanted was the actual release number of the software I was using. So I ran the program, and lo and behold, the bug's gone away. So you can see it here that Audacity is running in the clear under Windows. So I don't know if the feedback hub works, but nobody told me it was fixed. Anyway, it's fixed. But when I was looking at Audacity on my Linux box, it's under the sound and video menu, and I happen to notice that there's another listing in that menu for Hypnotics. So I was intrigued to find out what Hypnotics was, because that's a new application for me. Clearly something bundled with the current release of Linux Mint. Well, it turns out it's a free internet TV service. And you can see that it has 3,600 channels with no movies and no series, apparently. And when I checked on this thing, sure enough, it's a new feature in Linux Mint, the current release 20.1. And you'll notice it includes free legal and publicly available content. But it doesn't include any adult content. So that's a downer for some people, I guess. It groups the things by country. So there's a lot of US channels there, UK. I'm not sure that Japan and Korea are going to be, or Afghanistan are going to be terribly useful for me. But UK is always a possibility. So I click on UK and I find that there's lots and lots of different channels. None of these, I don't think, except for Euronews that I recognize. But if you browse down the list here, you'll find some that you probably know about. ITV here, independent television. Red Bull, which is a caffeine-laden drink, but this is a sports channel. And then there's a whole bunch of Sky channels over here, which again are, some of them are sports channels. And sure enough, if you pick on one of these channels, this is one of the UK series, action movies, and it loads a movie and you can watch the video and listen to the sound. And the problem with these kind of things, of course, is that it's streaming television. So I've got no idea what this movie is and when it started and how long it's going to run and that kind of thing. I guess somewhere on the web you can check on content that's being played on these channels and the time you're viewing appropriately. Here's another sports TV channel. I just obviously caught the tail end of this motor racing feature. And here is Euronews, and sure enough, you get European news on your video screen, display screen. Mint says that they're going to do further development of this thing. They're going to produce an EPG, an electronic program guide. So that would be useful for knowing what we're watching or when to watch. They're also looking at personal video recorders so you can record information. So you can, they're going to let you customize your channel categories, select favorite channels, hide unused content. Some of the channels that are listed don't display anything. So I think that's what they mean by unused content, maybe anyway. So anybody who's using Mint or Linux Mint, this is maybe one reason to dual boot your system or create a live distro and just try this out on a bootable CD or a bootable USB drive. Interesting program anyway. Okay, next share is from Chris.
Yeah, I knew about one of these for quite a few years now, but I know about software that's out there that will do uninstalls as a generic sort of thing. You just it can handle better uninstalling than sometimes the vendor's own utility for doing an uninstall. But there are some vendors who will put out specific tools for completely removing their own apps. And those are the ones that I'm sort of interested in because I figure they know best what they do to your system when they install it, and so they should know best on how to completely remove things. And they can also adjust it as they change their install routines. They could change their utility that does a more complete uninstall than you will get by just going to settings, apps, and saying you want to uninstall it. So the two I know about now are from McAfee and Microsoft Office. So McAfee gets work out with me every time I buy a new computer that comes with a free 90-day trial or whatever of McAfee. I use that utility to scrub it completely off of the computer, and I think it'll do a pretty good job of it. And then recently it came up about the idea of removing Microsoft Office, and they actually have a tool that is specifically designed to completely remove Office from your computer. So there's those two links if that's of use to anybody. I'd also like to put out a call if anybody knows of similar utilities for programs from other vendors. I think it'd be kind of nice if we share that information around. Just it may prove helpful to people at some point in time.
And John Fleming says he did a Google search for AVG removal tool and got a link to a program to do that, and it worked.
Oh, good. Okay. If you happen to know the link there, John, that would be great if you could paste that into the chat. And I'm presuming that this actually came from AVG people as opposed to some third party. The third party utilities will work. It's just that I think the ones coming from the vendor are more likely to do a good job without damaging your system by being overly aggressive.
Except in the uninstall tool you use in Windows, really an uninstall program in the installation folder, so presumably provided by the vendor?
Yeah, well, that's what you actually get if you go to Settings Apps and you click on it and you say you want to uninstall it. That's what gets done. But obviously, for example, McAfee, felt a need to put out a utility that does a better job than happens with that. I presume that's the reason why they put out their special utility. And the same thing for Microsoft Office. I presume it does something more than you will get if you just run the regular uninstall routine.
Yeah, I think some vendors are better than others. I find there's a lot of junk left lying around from some programs that I've uninstalled. Okay, Chris had already talked about the membership renewal, or at least the people wanting to buy a new membership. We've been pushing this for a little while, and we've had a bunch of new members. And this is the last call, mainly because the additional year's membership for current members kicks in tomorrow, April the 1st. It's not an April Fool's joke. You really do get an extra year on your paid up membership. But if anybody joins today or tonight within the next few hours, then you essentially buy 1 year's worth of membership, and we're going to extend that by an additional year. So last call. I had a look on my wife's phone the other day and found this text message, which I thought was interesting, I guess. It comes from a 4-digit number, so that's not a telephone number, clearly. It comes from the Pink Lady, whoever she is, we've got no idea, and it invites me to tap on this beautiful blue button to download something I know not what. So, I would think that's probably a scam. I mean, usually things that don't have any source necessarily that you can identify and just want you to click on something without telling you what they're doing, it should be a scam. But I thought I'm going to delete it anyway, but I thought I'd check and see what's going on. So it turns out that if you look for that 4735, that's a short code, which is used by both Rogers and Fido. And Fido is my wife's phone provider. And they're sending text messages to people using the short code. And that's the kind of message they send. So it's not a scam. I've got no idea what it is because I'm not going to open it anyway. So there we go. So I just remind you that next week we have a call out for recent scam messages or telephone calls that are scams. And we're going to take a look at what people have provided. And we're going to ask you if you've seen anything similar recently. So let's find out what's out there in the big bad world of fraud and scams. Okay, our next, our first question of the night is if anybody's done a recent upgrade to Windows 10. And this, I think, is from Natalie, who was going to upgrade from Windows 8 to Windows 10. But when she spoke to a technician, he said that over the last 3 months, about half of the attempts have failed. And once installed, Windows 10 wouldn't activate. So Natalie's not sure whether she should upgrade to from 8.1 to Windows 10. Personally, I would go ahead. I would certainly make a full disk image before I did anything as a fallback position. And then once I had the image built, then I'd do the upgrade. I'm sure, I've never had any real problems with Microsoft upgrades like that. So I'm suspicious that 50% of the time it won't activate. That seems unlikely. If it does go wrong, then you can always try contacting Microsoft, and there are some contact information on the web if you dig in there. Chris had an article recently in the newsletter with the link here on how to get help from Microsoft. And if I remember rightly, Chris, that was using the chat function, and then eventually you drill down and find a live body.
Yeah, basically the easiest, the article that I wrote actually had a little bit of a different way of going about it than I recommend. What I recommend is you just run Get Help. It's an app that is installed with Windows 10, and that will bring you to that dialogue that starts off with asking you, what is it you need help with? And you can put in real information or fake information or whatever, and just keep clicking on, no, your suggested answers don't help me. No, they don't help me. No, they don't help me. No, they really don't help me. And eventually, after about three of those, you will get to a spot where it says, do you want to talk to somebody? And if you say yes, you will have the option of either doing an online chat, or you can actually have them phone you. And so I went with the option of an online chat, and I was told I was something like 973 in the queue. And I thought, well, I'm going to be at my computer for the next while. I'll just leave it running. And about 5 or 10 minutes later, all of a sudden, I was doing an online chat with somebody. And so I highly recommend that if you do have a problem with something from Microsoft, go through that route. They were quite good. Some of the information I wanted, it was strictly just some background information, and they were able to get that to me. And I certainly think if you have problems with activation, they should be able to get you on track to get it activated, as long as you're not trying to use truly pirated piece of software. And so they are actually pretty good. So I recommend people try it out.
And as the last item on the slide says, if all else fails, then just restore the backup.
Yeah.
Both Chris and I really like disk images. They work really, really well. And just remember that today is World Backup Day, so you really should be making a full disk image of your complete system anyway.
And test your backups.
World Restore Day we need.
Yeah,
that's tomorrow, right. I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that information on how to contact Microsoft might be quite helpful to Jocelyn, who has another question. That should be question, not answer. Has anybody used Microsoft Teams recently? Jocelyn had a Teams session, and almost immediately afterwards got your password has changed message from supposedly from Microsoft. So he's asking, has anybody used Teams, and have you seen this kind of security alert asking you to check up on a password change? And it's really suspicious. I mean, it might be coincidental that it was immediately after using Teams, but Jocelyn noticed a couple of things in the message. One, it said that he was using the Android platform when he was actually on a Windows computer, so that doesn't make any sense. And the second problem was that the IP address, which they're quoting, was incorrect also. I don't know that anybody has seen issues like that and has any suggestions other than contacting Microsoft.
I guess one thing that I would say to that is, if you really don't need that Microsoft account, you can always create a brand new one. So if all you need it for is to be able to use something like Teams, Teams just needs a Microsoft account. So if this one's failing, just create a brand new one and start using that instead. You know, there's nothing magical about one particular Microsoft account, I don't think. So certainly not for things like to be able to use Teams.
Hi,
hey, with
Gwen.
Anybody.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I have used Microsoft Teams for our work meetings. And if she was getting some kind of an email about a password change, somehow that account got hacked, she needs to change that password. We've been using it since the pandemic and never had anything like that happen.
Yeah, so it may not be Teams, it may just be a coincidence. Who knows? Anyway, Dawson will try and sort it out. Okay, another problem. This is from Darlene. She's been seeing an ad in the promotions tab on her Android phone and can't delete it. But it doesn't show up in Gmail on the laptop, so that's a bit strange. And then when we were having this sort of discussion about it, the ad disappeared, and then it came back the next day. And this is the ad. You can see it's the order number at the top there. There's a package for you. Congratulations, your email has been selected for the award. Well, I don't think so. But it does say it's an ad, which is really weird. I mean, ads are supposed to be served up by Google, not by scanners. So not being able to delete the promotional ads, I did a little check on this thing. So I looked in my promotions folder, and you can see I look in my promotions folder almost all the time, because I've got 359 email messages in there, and I never look in this folder. And so I can click on the select all button up here, but you notice it selects all the messages in highlighted in blue, but it doesn't select the adverts. And the other thing is it's only the 50 messages on that page, so I'd have to do that, what, 7 or 8 times to get rid of 360 messages. Or I can try clicking on select all 359 conversations in the promotions folder, and if I do that, and then there's 2 ads still aren't there. And Chris tells me that, well, Gmail's ad supported, so clearly it's not going to let you delete the ads, because that's how you're paying to use their service. But you can go ahead and delete all the messages, and it tells you that your promotions tab is empty. Well, it's not quite empty, because the 2 ads are still there. But interestingly enough, even though it won't let you delete it, why does it give you a trash can icon if you hover over the message here? And it turns out if you hover over the message and actually delete the first message, and then hover over the second one and delete the second message, and the first one goes away, and then you can hover over this one and make that one go away, and now your promotions tab really is empty. You got rid of the ads as well as the messages. However, Chris is absolutely right, because the next day there are the messages or the ads back again, and a new message from XDA developers for me.
One thing you will get an effect is, if you delete ads, they say they will try not to send you ads like that. They're still going to send you ads, but they're not going to send you ads whatever like that means. And so But you're always going to have the ads appearing at the top, so I just ignore them. So.
Yeah, I never look. I never look in the spam folder. I never look in the promotions folder. I never look in the social folder. I just hide them and make them go away. Yeah. So Darlene's still got this problem with this weird ad, which I don't know. It either means that Google has allowed some nefarious guy to adverts on this system, which look a lot like scams, and there's a spammer has figured out how to break into their system and make his message go to promotions and look like an ad, and I don't know which it is. This is like feedback, but I've never had any success complaining to Google about people sending me emails or scams with a Google email address, make it go away. But there is help on the web, it says, if you try and contact them. And one of the things you can do is you can report a phishing email, and you have to right-click on the message, and then it brings up this report phishing option, which you can send to them, and they'll review it. And they say they'll review it, but they always review it, but they may not be able to get back to you. Well, I think I know what that means.
Actually, there is one other option too, Alan. If you go back a couple of slides, one more. Okay, so right to the right of where it says add, there's a little circle with an eye in it. If you end up clicking in that, it pops up with something and it says, I'll just read off. It says, why this ad? And it's a link. And if you click on that, why this ad, it actually takes you to a Google about this ad page, and you can block these ads, which again, will just block ads like that. You'll still get other ads, but there is another button there that says report this ad. So I presume if you click on the report this ad, then you could actually say why you find that particularly objectionable. And if it is something like a scam, presumably Google would do something about it.
Yeah, one would hope.
One would hope, yes.
One would hope. Okay. And the other place you can report things to, which again is not terribly useful. I looked on this site for something. I looked on the web for something about Google ads and scams, and I couldn't find anything. And these guys don't even know how to spell Google, I don't think. But they're there at Fraud Center, and maybe they have some more clout if they report something to Google than if I report something to Google. Who knows? It certainly wouldn't hurt to report it, because it certainly looks fishy. I mean, really fishy. Okay, it seems to be a Linux night tonight. I have a question from Glenn about end of life. He's running Ubuntu Linux version 20.10, which 20.10 is a code for date, so it's 2020 and the month of October, and that particular release has an end of life in July this year. So he's looking at installing 2104, which is the April edition, but that has an end of life in July 2022. So that would mean that he'd have a current system which would get security patches and all those good things. He says new releases of software like Windows often have bugs that can affect convenience, and early adopters can have problems. The new releases of Linux have bugs, and if so, how long do you recommend I wait before installing a new version of Ubuntu? Well, Windows has the Windows Insider program, and that does pre-releases of Windows patches to try and avoid bugs. But as we know, it's not always successful, and that's not too surprising given that the incredible market penetration of Windows and the level of hardware and software and bozo users like me who are out there trying to confuse their systems. And Linux does basically the same thing. They have developers, and they have people who test the new versions. And as far as I know, I don't think I've ever had a whole distro that's gone bad. I've had the occasional patch that hasn't worked properly. But Linux certainly has patches over time, not just at the beginning of a new release. The nice thing about Linux is that you can control which patches you accept, when you are willing to accept them, and so on and so forth. However, Linux can have its problems. So I actually have two machines. I have one machine I use for testing things. I call that development. And I have another machine, which is my daily driver, as it were. So I always update the development machine with any new release, but I'll delay the installation on the production machine until I'm sure things are working. Well, it's not really because I'm sure things are working. It's because the supreme user doesn't like change on the system. So I have to be somewhat careful when I make major changes to the production computer. I always make a disk image before I do any new installation. So I've always got a restore option if things really do go south. And personally, I always do a fresh install rather than trying to upgrade the existing version. I like that. It gives me a kind of a fresh start all the way around. And I clearly have a few things to do, tweaking settings and installing some programs that don't come bundled with the operating system. But I have this kind of to-do list in a word processing file. So I do my installation, then I just go through the list and make all the necessary changes. As I say, I don't think I've ever had a serious problem, so I'd be happy to install any new long-term support version. And I don't bother with these versions that are only good for a few months. I don't see any value in short-term updates like that. But by the same token, there's nothing wrong in waiting for a while, checking the various web forums and making sure that there's no problems before you do make the switch. However, I would note that if you check the Ubuntu release schedule, you will see that version 2104 has a really small shelf life. It's only good until the beginning, the end of this year, basically. And then you've got to install 2110, the October release, to carry over until you can get to the April release, which will be the next long-term support version, which is good for 5 years. So personally, rather than leapfrogging up this chain, I would actually go back and install 2004, because that's going to be good until way after the next long-term support version and comes into play. And I've never had a problem with long-term support versions and just updating them using the security patches as they come along regularly. So, as I say, I don't bother with these intermediate releases. Okay, that's it for all the questions, but we do have a share on tap, and so I will stop sharing my screen and turn it over to Tom.
Hello, everybody. Okay, and share screen. Have any of you actually dealt with the Windows firewall? And share.
I'm not seeing your screen yet, Tom.
It's coming.
Coming, okay, yeah.
Okay, so Windows Firewall, this is the Microsoft Management Console. And the firewall is here, and there are all kinds of rules here. The check marks are allow, and the no entry signs are block. And you can actually go into these, and you can view, you can add and remove columns. Let's see what the columns are here. There are a lot of columns of different things that you can actually choose to edit. Properties, programs and ports, advanced, all kinds of stuff. But this is rather arcane and difficult, and it's also not live. But there is another way to manage this firewall. It is much more intuitive. So if I go to, where is it? There it is. This is Binisoft. They have Windows Firewall Control. Malwarebytes has bought it. And it's a free download. It's quite mature. You can do a variety of things with it. And this is its thing down below. This is the task manager thing. And if I go there, I can, well, let's go to the main panel. This is the about dashboard, Windows firewall state is on. In other words, it's not turned off. And it will block those inbound and outbound connections that you want blocked. Profiles, you can actually immediately block things by clicking on the high filtering profile. And if you're having difficulty installing something, you can click on the low filtering profile. And this will actually stay around for a particular number of time. I think it's in options. It's not. Where is it? Security. Well, I can't remember where it is. But you can. It will turn itself off and go back to medium. Medium is outbound connections are blocked. Only programs with an allow rule are allowed. You can get notifications, and these appear in the corner of your screen down here. Let's go back there. There is a learning mode. I haven't really used it. You can disable the notifications. The options are you can integrate to the shell, and you can actually right-click on a program and allow it or specify what's allowed. And I have it starting automatically at the user logon. There are a variety of rules. This is a default. When you create a rule, it's usually created for outbound. Security. You can actually, secure boot means that when you actually shut down, the high filtering profile will be set at system shutdown. And it stays set when you log on again until you turn it off. You can also secure the profile, prevent other programs from changing it. And you can secure rules, and you can do things like allow Windows Store rules, and you can disable unauthorized rules. And there are a variety of groups. You can also import group names from existing rules, so you can actually just bring in the Stop that. You can bring in the rules that you already have. Tools, you can actually check with various checking by IP void to check the IP address. You can check a file and so on. And there's the about. And the other things that are here are the rules and the fire connections log. You can actually go into the connections log, and you can choose which you want to show, the allowed or the blocked, and what you want to show here. And here I have several. This is the NV container, which is NVIDIA container for my graphics card, and I can right-click on here, and I can customize and create a rule from the stuff that has been blocked. And it comes up, and it says, what was happening here. And it's actually a UDP to 5353, and this is basically looking for the DNS records. Custom addresses, this is actually my current address of my IP address of my machine on my router, and I just usually any because I want to apply to this machine no matter where I am, even if I'm at a coffee shop or something. And custom addresses, this is the address that is in all of these. and direction is outbound, action is allow, and you can actually specify different interface types, but I want to create this and I want to allow it for all of that. So now it'll be able to look at the DNS records. You can also look at these if you go to customize and create, you can also look at what's here and see what it's doing. And I don't want GlassWire to do anything, so I'm not going to allow it or create a rule. The rules look something like this, and they're a little easier to manage. You can sort them. It's a little hard to sort when my Zoom controls are at the top. Let's see if I can bring this down a bit. But you can sort by the group, the name, or the program, and so on. And you can go through and you can look at these, see what the rules are, and this is a much nicer way, I find, of looking at your firewall rules if you want them. But I don't really usually manage these. These ones are pink because they're blocking, while the green ones are allow, and the white ones are there, but they're not enabled. You can also combine rules. For example, if I show duplicate rules, looks like I've done this before, so I can control click on there, and I can actually merge the rules. So there's only one rule, and looks like they're all the same. I don't want to change anything there or anything there. It's allow and it's outbound. Great. And it's now it's a merged rule. And the same thing for the other ones. You can't merge them if they're one is in and one is out. For example, if I try to merge this one and this one, it won't let me merge them because they're different directions. So you can look at things that have wanted the things. If you actually try to go to a program that you have, you get notifications from Windows Firewall Control if something is trying to access the internet that you have not given or denied permission to already. And then you can choose what to do with that. You can create a rule right away that is very specific or very general, or you can just allow the program. For example, I can't give you an example because I don't have anything that I can show. The place to get this program is, I put it in chat. Whoops.
Justin's already posted it, Tom.
Tom, just a question that might work in terms of getting something to pop up. What if you were to open a command prompt and run telnet?
Okay.
And try to telnet to something and see if it creates a pop-up. So I don't know where you'd want to go to. I guess if you just, and anywhere out on the internet. Oh, telnet.
I guess okay. I've disabled it.
How about FTP?
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, if you just do an open space and then just try opcug.ca or something like that. Or anywhere. Doesn't really matter as long as it exists in DNS. Okay, there we go.
So this is, it says it's blocked. You can choose to customize the rule. You can allow the program, which allows it to do everything. You can block it forever and ever. You can block for now and ask later. If you choose to customize the rule, then you can turn that off, local ports. You can that's remote IP. If you do anything here, then it's not, then you're limiting it to that particular IP. So I don't want to do anything. If you go back to rule details, you're back here.
Yeah, so I think typically on something like that, if you think it's a malicious program or there's a chance that it's a malicious program, you just say block it.
Yep.
Otherwise, if you know that it's something you're trying to do, you could just say allow this, and then it'll create the rule that will allow it in the future. That's not bad. That's not bad.
Yeah, and if you go, for example, if I right-click on here, connections log, and there's the file transfer program.
Yeah, that's FTP, yeah.
And if I customize and create... As you can see, I can if I right-click on here, I can allow the program, block the program, I can customize and create. You can open the file location to see where it is if you want to delete it, although it does show here. You can check the file. And presumably it's off in my... well, it's not in this one. At any rate, it will go off into the particular programs. You can also, let's see if I can do IP void. You can check, you can start a whois query on the IP address. You can verify it. You can search the rules to see if it's already there. For example, if I search the rules, there's NV container.
To do a lot.
You can also search down here. And here's where it actually put in, whoops. Here's where it actually put in the search thing as to what it was searching for. And it was searching for the program. And so this is the, these are disabled rules for NVIDIA Corporation. And this is a block. I wonder why that's there. That's strange. If I go here. I trust this, so I'm going to just delete it, and you can right-click and delete, or you can just actually press the delete key. Maybe that's why I was getting...
When you first install this program, how many things does it block before you kind of sort out the rules that you want?
When I first installed this, I just basically allowed all the current rules, and from then on, any new programs or that I were not in, already in the firewall rules, because the firewall rules are created when by a variety of programs when they install themselves, and so I basically trusted everything that was there before, since I hadn't noticed any viruses, so. And then I just waited for the notices for things that showed up as trying to access the internet that there was not a rule. And if you look, let's see, this is all the rules. If I click on the X here, shows all the rules. The red ones here are I think these are program paths of this rule is not accessible. Yeah, these are rules that are invalid because the particular programs don't exist anymore. So, for example, I can just press the delete key, and they're gone. You can show duplicate rules because I don't know why, but I have a lot of duplicate rules that I go through and prune every now and then.
Alan, to speak to your question, I think I use Glasswire, which does a lot of very similar functions to this, is not free. Well, there is a free version, but it doesn't do all of the things I wanted. And I find when I install it on a new Windows installation, I will have probably, a flurry of activity for, the first day. And then I will have some activity, pop-ups every now and then for the next week or so. And then after that, it's very rare that things come popping up. But if you don't have any firewall rules already covering a bunch of apps, Because by default, the Windows firewall will allow outbound connections. And, you know, this is specifically designed to allow you to prevent outbound connections. So you do get a flurry of activity for sure when you first start using the program. But it's relatively minor. And I would say after about a week or so, you don't get pop-ups very often.
I guess the other question related is, when you do see a pop-up, if you're just a, you know, Joe user, is the information enough that you realize whether you should allow it or block it?
Yes, because you can see what the where the program is and what ports it's trying to use on the in and out. By the way, that's another thing too. If well, here let's do a customized merge rules here. You can see what protocol it's using, which is the choices. TCP, UDP, a whole variety of protocols, or it can be any. You can see what local ports. I usually, when a program is using, trying to access the internet, it usually chooses a variety of ports of different sizes. And basically, I just choose. You can go in here and click all ports. Then it uses the remote ports are usually special, so I leave them alone. Local addresses, again, I get rid of, choose any. Remote addresses, of course, stay the same. But you can restrict, for example, let's see. If we go back to all the rules and refresh the list so it's not duplicates, you can see that so there are a variety of things, and you can see, if I go into the thing here, that there are particular addresses. SOPRA update uses this particular address, and I've changed it to all ports, and then, of course, it's using 443, which is the secure port or the SSL port. This is the Opera updater, and you can manage these. And Ubuntu Firewall Advanced Security, you get back here with Windows Defender Firewall, so you can actually access the firewall and look at the inbound rules and the firewall and so on. But you do need to have administrator access for the firewall, I believe. But you don't need administrator access for this unless you choose it. It's in the, let's go back to the main security. I think you can set a password for it, for accessing this, but I'm not quite sure. I haven't done it because I'm the only user of this machine.
One of the things I do, Alan, is when you ask the question about, you know, how do you know whether to allow or disallow? One of the things that if you're most paranoid, I guess, that you can do is you can always see the path to the executable that is trying to access the internet. And then you can not allow any traffic, but then what you can do is go to that executable and submit it to virustotal.com. And so a VirusTotal with 70-odd antivirus engines on it, all with up-to-date signature files, if all of them come back saying it's not malicious, then I would allow the traffic. You know, there is going to be some instances where you know right up front that, oh, yes, you know, I just loaded my web browser, and it's saying that, you know, my web browser is being blocked. Well, if you just loaded it, then you know that your web browser, you want to allow it to access the internet, so you can just say yes. But, yeah, if it's an unknown program, that's what I would recommend, is that don't allow the traffic right away. Submit the executable to VirusTotal, and if it comes back clean, then say, okay, and let it create the rule to allow it in the future.
And you can do this automatically from the Windows Firewall Control by right-clicking on it and choosing Check This File. And if you go over here.
Oh, okay, so it's doing VirusTotal. Good, yeah.
And it basically all it does is it sends in a hash of the file,
yeah,
to be checked, and then it checks to see whether that hash has been associated with a problem in any of the detectors in VirusTotal.
Yeah. So if, also, even a single one comes back saying that it's got a problem, I won't allow that program to access the internet. If it is only one, then it's probably a false positive, but I'll check the next day. If it's still only one, I figure for sure it's a false positive and I will let it access the internet. Otherwise, if more and more are popping up saying it's malicious, then it probably is malicious. And in that case, you definitely want to leave it blocked.
I don't usually allow any program to access the internet unless I've just installed it or I know what it's doing. If it's something comes up, it'll have to give me another indication as to what the problem is, if it has a problem, if it can't access the internet. But ordinarily, you're only going to get those pop-ups either when you install a program or there's a program update, and then it's usually an update of NVIDIA or one of the other things in my computer that needs a driver update.
Yeah, I really like the idea that you can do that, check this file, and it will submit it automatically to VirusTotal. That's a really nice feature.
Yeah, you can do that also from the file location, not just from the rules, but you can do it from the file location as well. It's from the from the connections log. Let's get back here. So GlassWire Control Service, right click. You can check this file, and bingo, there's the VirusTotal. Apparently, these things don't use the same hash. And if I go back there, you can also check. You can start a whois query on the IP address. Amazon isn't that helpful. You can also right-click on it and verify this IP address, which uses IP void, scan report. And I'm not a robot. Crosswalks. Well, it doesn't like me. I have this thing pretty well tied down with as you can see. Sorry, I didn't go down. Possibly safe. 0 of 115 sites say it's bad. Their first DNF is CloudFront, which is apparently it's CloudFront owned by Amazon. Apparently, it is. And I can find out where it is.
What does it have to be totally safe?
There it is.
It's in the middle of the ocean.
Middle of the ocean. Well, it's... What? It's in the Cheney Reservoir.
Cool.
Next to the Cheney Wildlife Area. Weird as it sounds, which is near Wichita, Kansas, which is a little odd. I guess Amazon, I guess they have really good cooling for their servers in the middle of a lake or reservoir. So that's Windows Firewall Control. I find it useful to manage firewall rules. It's not, and I'm not an expert in the Windows Firewall at all, but it looks a lot simpler and it's a lot easier to manage than going to the actual firewall itself in the management console and doing things there. So that's it. Any questions? Unmute yourself.
Wants to know is GlassWire or this program, are they more or less equivalent?
Very similar from my experience with GlassWire. GlassWire seems to be a little bit more maybe polished or simplified so that the stuff that is really critical is surfaced a little bit easier, I think. But all of the capabilities of it, you would have to go for the paid version of GlassWire. And it's not cheap. So it's a yearly subscription that you're paying for with Glasswire. So this being free certainly has that charm. And it's a little bit more complex looking, but it looks like it can do pretty much everything that Glasswire can do.
And John's asking, does a premium antivirus program normally handle all this kind of firewall control?
I don't know whether they use the firewall. They may or may not, but they would certainly have controls on stuff going in and out, as well as looking at the content of the files that are doing things. So an antivirus program like Windows Defender or other programs, Sophos or Malwarebytes or Hitman Pro, are going to do more in terms of looking into the programs that are running or attempting to run or being downloaded. Windows Firewall Control just controls the firewall rules that determine whether a program can access the internet, either sending stuff out or receiving stuff in. And that, I think, is quite important, even if it doesn't actually look at the content of the files. There are other programs for that, and I just use Windows Defender plus some other antivirus programs that I only run scans on every so often rather than using them as live programs. My live virus is the Defender's Windows Defender for Microsoft.
Some of the security suites definitely do include advanced firewalls. Now, whether they are completely isolated firewalls or they work just with the Windows firewall like this one does and like Glasswire does, I suspect that more and more of them are just tying into the Windows firewall and just creating and modifying rules that are existing there. So I think they're probably very similar. They probably are simpler user interfaces than Windows Firewall Control, and probably a little bit simpler interface than even the Glasswire product. But they would do similar types of things, or the aim would be to provide that functionality of the two-way firewall, certainly, where you can be blocking outbound programs quite easily. That's one of the big problems with the Windows Firewall, is that it just allows outbound traffic unless you specifically go in and create a rule that says block it. So Microsoft doesn't want people saying, oh, all of a sudden my computer's not working because of a firewall rule that gets created or something like that. So that's why they allow all outbound traffic without question. And so, yeah, other programs will give you some more granular control like that, but probably not as granular as either this program or Glasswire.
And John's asking, do Windows Defender and antivirus run at the same time?
No.
Well, they shouldn't. If we're talking about a second antivirus program, Defender is an antivirus program.
Yeah.
And you don't need to, and you shouldn't run another real-time antivirus program at the same time, because they'll probably try and conflict.
Defender will turn itself off if you install another antivirus.
Yeah, it should, and vice versa as well. So, two on-access antivirus programs is not a good idea. However, it's worth noting that Windows Defender will run, even if you have another on-access antivirus program, it will run as an on-demand scanner periodically. And in that case, it's very useful because it there is no conflict if it's running on an on-demand scan. And it does provide you with an extra check of antivirus on your system. So it's actually quite a good thing. You can turn it off if you really don't want it happening, but it is on by default.
What program is that?
Windows Defender.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does that every so often.
Yeah.
Hitman Pro is also pretty good, and the free version does not do things live except as a trial. But it will check your running, what's happening on your computer currently when you log on, and also every at midnight each night.
And if you've done any of, listened to any of Chris's antivirus presentations at the library and at the club here, you'll realize his sage advice is to pick an antivirus program and run it and keep it updated. And if you run it, do a full system scan and make sure that there are no viruses on your system right this minute. Once it's doing an on-access scan, it will keep your system clean. So everything should be just fine.
You can also download ISOs to create a CD or a USB key that you can run the antivirus from that doesn't, and then you boot from that, and it will do a very clean scan, especially for any rootkits that that will hide itself when Windows boots. So Windows Defender has that, and I think Kaspersky and a bunch of others provide that offline scanning. When you boot them up, they usually update their things if they have internet access, and then they run. But of course, you would download that on another computer and then run it on your own computer, the computer that you want to test separately.
Okay, before we wrap up tonight, we did have one comment from Serge Eric about uninstallers. To check how good a third-party uninstaller is, install the trial version, Revo, iShampoo, iObit, etc. Install some piece of software, reboot, uninstall the software, reboot, and then launch a search in the registry with the name of the software. And so if it's not cleaning up properly, it may be leaving things lying behind in the registry, which is not necessarily as bad as some people might think it is. There's lots of things that can be in the registry that just sit there and don't do any bad. But he says some so-called uninstallers do not remove everything as claimed. Some people who try out software often use deep freeze to really wipe everything linked to a newly installed software. So deep freeze is basically it takes an image of aspects of your system and can return it to exactly that state afterwards.
Sounds like system restore.
Yeah, essentially. Well, it does better than system restore. But
it's the same type of software that libraries use at the end of the day.
It's sort of like imaging it, so you're basically returning it to a previous state. So you can install some stuff, see if it does bad things and so forth, and then return to the state your computer was in the last time you ran deep freeze.
Just by a simple reboot.
Yeah.
Usually a good idea to take a look on the C drive as well, because sometimes there are folders which these programs leave lying around with configuration information and data files and that kind of stuff.
Trouble is they can be scattered all over the place, and it can be really, really difficult to track down what a program has actually done.
It can be, although there's a program called Everything that you can run that basically indexes the file, every file name on your system. And if it's if the program name is inside the file name or in the folder that it's in, then you can find it fairly easily that way.
Okay, well, I posted in the chat if there are any other questions, and we've answered everything that I've seen or heard, so I think we're about that time of night where I can do the promos coming up. On Monday, April the 12th, 4 p.m., Chris is going to be doing a tech cafe for the library on how the internet works and doesn't sometimes. So if you want to know all about the internet, Chris knows everything there is to know about the internet.
Yeah, right.
And if you want to share photos for free, then Linda knows exactly how to do that and is going to be our guest speaker at the April meeting, which will be Wednesday the 14th of April. So if you're interested in sharing photos with your friends and relatives and so forth, then that's the place to be. And then finally, the next Q&A session will be, of course, next Wednesday, April the 7th. And if you have questions ahead of time, send them into suggestion box. And thanks, everyone, for attending, and hope you found something useful. Bye for now.
Thanks for coming, folks. We'll see you next week.